This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 2009 is swiftly coming to an end, and what a year it has been. The economic downturn has been felt in almost all parts of Charlotte. Budget problems have propped up at all levels of state and local government, and the school system felt the pinch as well. The fate of Bank of America has kept a lot of Charlottians on the edge of their seats. We witnessed a changeover in city government with a new mayor replacing Pat McCrory after 14 years of service. United Way and DSS found themselves embroiled in scandals, and former North Carolina Governor Mike Easley is also the subject of various investigations. And that just scratches the surface. So we're going to use this hour to look back on the year with four reporters who, among them, have covered it all. Simone Orendine and Julie Rose hail from the WFAE newsroom. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Joining us in our Spirit Square studio along with them is Rob Brovere, weekday morning anchor at Time Warner Cable's News 14 Carolina, the city's 24-hour news channel. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And award-winning Charlotte Observer columnist Tommy Tomlinson is also here. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
Very welcome. At the beginning of 2009, we were still worried about the acquisition of Wachovia by Wells Fargo and what that would mean to the city, but it didn't take long for our attention to shift up Tryon Street for the announcement of the acquisition of Bank of America, by Bank of America, of Merrill Lynch. But the excitement over that didn't last long, and much of the rest of 2009 has been spent wondering about the fate of our last big bank. So we're going to start this year-end news roundup there. And for that, we've invited Associate Professor of Finance at the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte, Tony Plath, to spend a few minutes with us. So, Tony Plath, would you say that the Bank of America story, insofar as Charlotte is concerned, was the biggest story of the year?
Yeah, Mike, I think it would be hard to argue that there's anything that overshadowed that this year. The search for a CEO, the bank's trouble with the government, the litigation that presents itself to the bank in New York, all of those things have made a really tumultuous year for the bank.
And it all began on January 1st of 2009 when it was announced that B of A bought Merrill Lynch.
Well, probably began in September of 2008 when they did the deal. They closed the deal January of 2009.
When this announcement came out on January 1st, did it look like a good thing for Charlotte? That was before we found out about before Ken Lewis evidently found out that there
were
problems.
Oh, yeah, it really did. Jobs, from the standpoint of creating the largest financial services company on the planet,
right.
From the standpoint of uniting mortgage and brokerage and investment banking and commercial banking, I think if you go back to January, we all thought this was going to be good for the community.
But not for long, because 15 days later...
Long. Well, 15 days later, they announced that they just lost almost $15 billion, and they had anticipated that they were going to lose a little less than $8 billion. So the increase in the loss was the fuse that ignited the firestorm.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first quarterly loss that Bank of America had reported in 17 years.
If you look, the bank had really been an earnings juggernaut over the course of the 1990s and into the early 2000s. They're a consumer bank. They were very profitable because they did a lot of lending. They had investment banking. They had brokerage. They had a mortgage business. They had all of the pieces. They just didn't have the scale that Merrill and Countrywide gave them later on.
4 months later, in April, the end of April, actually, a scenario began to develop that we in Charlotte had seen before with Ken Thompson at Wachovia. First, he was stripped of his chairmanship. Then he lost control of the bank. And Ken Lewis was stripped of his chairmanship by the board on April 29th.
Yeah, at the annual meeting.
And then later on in the year announced that he would be leaving the bank. Another thing happened over the course of this year with the bank, and that is because of the government troubles and the TARP money, the government insisted that the board of directors be reshaped.
The government put the bank under an MOU. That's a memorandum of understanding that ordered the bank to do a number of things. One of the things they were ordered to do was strengthen corporate governance and get a board that was more financially savvy, had more professional experience in the financial services industry, and they've done that. They pretty much reshaped the board over the last 6 months.
And one of the reasons that Ken Lewis got himself in trouble was because of this acquisition of Merrill Lynch and what he knew and who knew what when and who made who do what. Will we ever know what the government's influence on going through?
I think if you listen to the testimony before the House Oversight Committee, it's real clear. The additional $20 billion that the government injected was basically a quid pro quo. The bank had trouble completing the deal because because of the magnitude of Merrill Lynch's losses. And so Ken went to the government and said, I'd like to pull out of the deal. And the government said, no, we'll give you the extra capital cushion you need to absorb Merrill Lynch's losses. It was a real simple story in the end, but like most things political, it became complicated over the course of the year.
And of course, he was forced to resign. He announced his resignation.
It's real telling. If you look, Adolphus Towns the other day, when Moynihan was made CEO at Bank of America, was appointed to the CEO's job, you know, his comment in the New York Times was, I hope that the bank is grateful for what the government did for the bank. My thought at that time was, gratitude's a two-way street. I sure hope Congress is grateful for what Bank of America did for Congress, because remember, in the 11th hour in the fall of 2008, when Merrill Lynch was melting down, after Wachovia had failed, after Lehman had failed, after Fannie and Freddie had failed, Bank of America stepped in and essentially rescued Merrill Lynch from failure. And if Merrill had gone down, it would have been a much more catastrophic series of events in the American economy in 2009.
So Ken Lewis looks like the fall guy in all of this. Because
he sacrificed his career for the good of the country in order to complete a deal he didn't want to do.
Exactly right. And paid off the TARP money
early. And was capable of paying it off 6 months ago, but the government wouldn't let him. He had to wait until January to do that.
So please explain to me why he has to leave.
I don't have a good answer for
that. Okay, all right.
He has to leave because the government has indicated that they want different leadership within the company. They want a stronger board within the company. He committed the unpardonable sin. He essentially went public in New York State under oath and said that the government forced the bank to do a deal they didn't want to do. That's socialism at the end of the day.
And so he has to pay the price for being honest?
It looks that way to me. And a lot of other
people. So the new head of Bank of America, Brian Moynihan, has been with the bank since they took over Fleet Boston.
2004. He's from Fleet.
And there are those who say, he's a lawyer by trade.
He's an attorney.
That he doesn't have enough banking experience, and he's about to run the biggest bank in the world.
That's a fair statement. I mean, there have been people that have argued that. There are two issues about, I think, Brian's candidacy that confounded his selection. You mentioned the first, and that is he doesn't have broad-based experience in running a consumer bank. He's had a variety of jobs at Fleet Boston and then at Bank of America. He's known as being very bright. He's known for being very hardworking and a down-to-earth guy, but he hasn't run a big consumer bank. The other issue is his candidacy is tainted because of his association with Ken and his role in the Merrill Lynch deal. The institutional investors at the bank clearly wanted to see an external candidate, a non-Bank of America insider, lead the company, and it proved to be impossible to find someone when the bank was so heavily regulated and under Tim Geithner's thumb to do that.
And yet he's an attorney by trade. He has had a lot, as Ken Lewis, when he introduced him at the meeting at Spirit Square last week, he said, you probably know this guy because he's had a lot of different jobs at the bank.
Yeah.
I mean, he's had his fingers.
He's run the investment bank. He's essentially had credit cards. He's had the consumer bank since August. Uh-huh. So they did move him into the consumer bank position, the top job in the consumer bank. But at the same time, your statement's correct. He has not had a lot of experience running a broad-based consumer bank. That's an impediment to his ability to lead in the future.
And I guess because he is an attorney by trade, did he not essentially take over as general counsel at the hearings on Capitol Hill for the bank?
For a very short period of time when they were negotiating the Merrill Lynch acquisition, and the previous general counsel had been dismissed from the bank. He stepped in and filled that role.
As a lieutenant of Ken Lewis's.
And a loyal one.
And a loyal one for the longest time. He took a lot of different jobs, but he didn't go places where other people who would take those jobs would go. He stayed in Boston.
He did. In fact, he turned down the credit card division, running the credit card division, because that would have required him to move to Delaware. He didn't want to move to Delaware.
And he said no.
So that was I was holding my breath when he accepted the job as the CEO, because if he didn't want to go from Boston to Delaware, would he want to go from Boston to Charlotte? And apparently the answer to that is yes.
Well,
I understand it. A condition for his accepting the job was that he would move to Charlotte and the headquarters would remain in Charlotte.
As I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, he had to sign a piece of paper that said the headquarters would remain here.
I've heard that too.
Why? If given the fact that the government has made the Bank of America completely change the makeup of the board of directors so that none of the members of the board of directors are from Charlotte now, none of them.
Or from North Carolina.
Would they, as the board of directors, care where the headquarters was?
I think
who made this happen? I guess
The board obviously does, but there's something to be said for continuity. The bank is known here. The bank is well regarded here. The bank's administrative infrastructure is here.
It's cheaper
there's
run
a
here.
Good labor force here. Cheaper there's a lower cost of living here. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why Charlotte is a good destination city for banking. That's why Electrolux is coming here. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, remember the external candidates, and there were five or six of them that looked at the job, pretty much to a person indicated that they wanted the headquarters to move to New York. So we were all holding our breath for much of the year wondering whether or not that would happen or not.
How binding is this agreement?
Never say never. It's not binding in perpetuity. We'll have to wait and see what the board wants to do in the future. I don't think after all of the media attention and all of the drama associated with the search for a CEO, this isn't a company that has any additional appetite for drama. And a headquarters relocation would be drama. Yeah. They're not going anywhere for 2 years.
Tony Bleth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And so we sit around the table here for our new our end of year or news roundup with Simone Orendine and Julie Rose from WFAE News, Rob Beauvais from News 14 Carolina, and Tommy Tomlinson from the Charlotte Observer. Anything to add from what Tony Plath had to say about either Brian Moynihan or Ken Lewis or the bank or how long this headquarters might remain here? What are you hearing at the paper, Tommy?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about not just the stories of the year but the stories of the decade. And obviously the banks have been such a huge story for the entire 10 years. If you think about it, when the decade started, 2000-2001, Hugh McColl passed the leadership of Bank of America to Ken Lewis. Ed Crutchfield passed the leadership of what was then First Union to Ken Thompson. So the two Kens were sort of running the two big institutions in Charlotte. And not long after that, First Union merged with Wachovia. So you had these two powerhouse banks here. And what's happened since then to both those, that you end up at the end of 2009 with both Kens out of work at those places and all the things that happened, not just here, but to the economy as a whole, to put them in those two spots is pretty astonishing, I think.
Yeah. And I would just say, too, I think this is the year that we sort of learned what it's going to be like to not have Wachovia headquartered in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was one thing we were all so worried about, and Charlotte took kind of a hit to its ego, losing the Wachovia headquarters. But, you know, by a lot of accounts, Wells Fargo has not laid off as many people as maybe a lot of us expected to see laid off. And while we now know the tower is going to be Duke Energy Center rather than the Wachovia Tower, we also are hearing that Wells Fargo has actually got more people employed here in Charlotte now than Wachovia did by some
really?
By some counts. So there's actually, you know, we aren't the Wells Fargo headquarters, we're the East Coast headquarters, but you know, maybe it's not such a terrible thing after all, is a lot of what I'm hearing.
But they have consolidated their square footage. I know the next year they're going to be moving into just a few of the towers
right.
that they used to occupy sprawlingly. So, Rob?
I'm wondering how much of a difference is it really going to make considering the scope and size of these two companies. I remember talking to some city council members when Ken Lewis took over, complaining about the fact that they used to be able to make a phone call to Hugh McColl if indeed they needed something, because Hugh McColl was and still is very involved with the community and quite proud of Charlotte, whereas Ken Lewis seemed to be above the fray to a degree and not as involved in Charlotte as his predecessor. Ken Thompson perhaps a little bit more, but I'm wondering, will Brian Moynihan, who does not have the ties to Charlotte that his predecessors did, if indeed he will be as involved in the community as the others, and if indeed it really matters, if Bank of America headquartered in New York City and a couple of dozen people left, as we can see with Wells Fargo, has taken over Wachovia, and not too much has changed so far, at least.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the economy, United Way, DSS, CMS, and many, many other things that hit the newspapers and the television and the radio in 2009. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by First Night Charlotte, an Imagination celebration, New Year's Eve, 8 till 12:30 a.m. with 50 diverse entertainment and cultural activities. Family-friendly, alcohol-free environment, tickets at Harris Teeter or firstnightcharlotte.com. Well, tomorrow we are going where the wild things are, in the company of Amelia and the fantastic Mr. Fox. We won't wait until 2012 to go on a couples retreat to Planet 51. All indications are that we'll run into some old dogs, but the experience of this Twilight saga will be Precious. These are all names of holiday movies that are out just in time for Christmas, and we've assembled a collection of film critics, two to be precise, to talk about all of these. This is actually an encore presentation of a show we did a couple of weeks ago, but since you'll have a lot of time on your hands in the next couple of days, we thought we'd repeat that show to let you know what's good and bad in the theaters, and that's tomorrow morning at 9.
Tis the season for shopping and giving. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, last-minute gift buying, and end-of-year donations, what consumer holiday spending and charitable giving trends tell us about the strength of the nation's economy. The Diane Rehm Show, Wednesday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting around our Spirit Square table with Simone Arendine and Julie Rose from WFAE News, Rob Beauvais from News 14 Carolina, and Tommy Tomlinson from the Charlotte Observer. And looking back on the big stories of 2009, particularly as they pertain to Charlotte, the economy at large had an impact across the country last year or this past year. What's the employment picture been like in Charlotte this year? It's been pretty tough here, tougher than many other parts of the country, in fact.
Well, we started out in January with a 10.5% unemployment rate for the Charlotte, Gastonia, Concord area, one of the highest in the country for the large metro areas. And by October of this year, the most recent numbers were at 12%, and still hearing that it could go up to 13 before the end of this recession.
Well, I spoke also with the local Fed economist here at the office in Charlotte, who said he's seeing that was probably the worst of the number, and that Charlotte region should start to come out of that. So it might not, varying numbers, obviously.
I mean, we had the announcement last week of Electrolux planning to locate here. There was an announcement in the paper this morning of yet another company bringing
a thousand jobs.
Yeah, 1,000 jobs. And it's interesting because what this company basically is doing is replacing a lot of the jobs that the banks shed during all these years of mergers and buyouts and that sort of thing. And so there's kind of an irony there that we are getting new jobs, but they're basically sort of replacing the old jobs we used to have, probably at lower salaries and with fewer benefits. And that, I think, is sort of a theme of this year. I mean, I think of this year as sort of a year of instability. You know, you have people who are unemployed, people who are losing their homes to foreclosure, people who are losing their savings in the stock market. And then that goes all the way up to institutionally, the banks are sort of the foundation of the city. You see the foundation start to crack a little bit. Mm-hmm. Institutions like the United Way and like DSS have had big institutional problems where people, I think, the ground just isn't quite as solid as it used to be.
Okay. And we've also, what sectors aside from banking have taken the biggest hit?
Well, I was going to point out, weirdly enough, this has still been a good year for Charlotte. If you talk to the Chamber of Commerce, prior to yesterday's announcement of 1,000 jobs, they're stating that Charlotte has created over 11,500 jobs this year, new jobs. So, and across the board, there's no one particular sector. What other sectors have taken the hit?
Manufacturing is where the biggest hit has been. I mean, over the year, that's by far construction, manufacturing, the two biggest, and then, financial services is much further down the line.
But we should note that manufacturing's been going down for the past decade now, so that number always remains high. I would say the really biggest sector to be hit is construction, again, with the housing troubles and cutting back on building and not being able to get the credit to keep business going for these companies, contractors.
One of you alluded to what would the impact be going forward without the Huma calls of the town making things happen. And Huma call and the big banks here have always been big philanthropists and very involved in making things happen in the arts community, et cetera. And this year has been, I think, notable for the fact that in this economic downturn, a lot of private citizens have gotten involved in donating a great deal of money to keep things afloat. The Charlotte Symphony, it was announced today, has made its goal. They will be funded going forward by the Arts and Science Council, which had threatened to pull funding if they couldn't get a matching grant. And that matching grant came to be came to fruition because of the Levines, who have been really active this year in philanthropy.
Well, the Levines, I quit counting the number of things that they gave stuff to, gave money and resources to over the years. Dick Spangler just recently gave a large amount of money to West Charlotte for a scholarship program here. I mean, one thing to remember is the boom times here created a great deal of wealth and a lot of wealthy people. And so now I think some of those wealthy people who were giving in one way or another to begin with really see a vacuum here in that the institutions that we're used to sort of publicly and sort of the large companies here who are not able or as willing to give as they used to, I think private individuals are certainly stepping forward there.
Of course, one of the institutions that you talk about that helps people out is the United Way. And this year, the United Way has spent a great deal of time explaining, or not explaining, the goings-on behind the scenes with Gloria Pace King, her retirement package, her salary package, etc. And, of course, Gloria Pace King has departed but is in the process of legally dealing with the United Way. They now have new leadership. What has been the impact of all of this on the United Way and their ability to do what it is that they do in the community?
Well, I think Jane McIntyre, formerly with the YWCA, her hiring over at the United Way was sort of seen as a big turning point for the agency. I mean, she's known as a fixer and very competent, very well-respected. Now, she knew she had a big, big challenge in front of her to try and raise money, meet the goals, especially in this economic time, and they have not come close to meeting the fundraising goals that they had hoped. They've extended the deadline sort of indefinitely for their capital campaign. And this was also the year that we saw a 35% cut in funding to agencies from the United Way. So, you know, every agency that's funded by the United Way that I'm hearing from, I mean, they're hopeful, but right now it's almost as though now it's the economy that's the bigger issue for them. You know, they're, and Jane McIntyre is doing everything she can, apologizing at every turn.
Have they done a sufficient job of explaining to people what went wrong and how they allowed it to go wrong, if in fact it did go wrong? Because there are people who think that maybe it didn't go wrong.
No. I mean, the board has not come forward, I think, and given a satisfactory answer as to why it did not have oversight as to her contract. That's just a personal view, in my opinion. But.
Well, I mean, I think it's one of those things that happens not just in Charlotte but in a lot of places where a person and a board of directors don't have much oversight of them. And so they all think, well, this is a great idea to increase this person's salary or provide some money for a pension or something like that. And you see that in private industry all the time with the CEO pay, where the boards tend to say, well, it's a capital idea to hand out bigger bonuses when if they were at street level, they probably wouldn't see it that way.
And if indeed she was doing her job and it was a successful fundraiser, and if indeed she's doing her job, then perhaps why worry about that?
Well, that's kind of a nebulous thing, but this has been the year when people have really taken an angry look at CEO compensation and perks from Wall Street to the troubled banks to the United Way through other nonprofit organizations where people are making extraordinary, at least by average standards, extraordinary amounts of money. And even in our local government, bonuses were given to the leaders while salaries or raises were frozen. Will there be fallout from all this, or will this too pass with time, do you think? Will there be a change?
That's a good question. I mean, I think when the economy comes back, I mean, that will be the time when we'll know. Because when the economy rebounds and Charlotte's a little flush again, the question is this stuff going to be forgotten because everybody has a little more money in their pocket? Mm-hmm. Or will it bring some long-term change? I hope and believe that now that this is sort of, we've sort of seen how the sausage is made a little bit in a way that we had not seen before or people had not paid attention to before. And I think that for that reason, now that people have seen that, and it's a little bit clearer what happens in those sorts of situations, I think it will be more difficult to get that sort of stuff past us the next time.
That is the Charlotte Observer's Tommy Tomlinson. He's here along with Simone Orendine and Julie Rose from WFAE News and Rob Bovier from News 14 Carolina. You were about to jump in there, Julie.
I was just going to say, when it comes to banks and big corporations, we're already seeing that there may not be a huge change, ahead. As soon as one of the reasons Bank of America was so eager to pay off the TARP money was they could get out from under the thumb of the Paysar and, be able to pay what they want to pay. And, there really is in private industry, there's very little the government can do to say you can't pay or give out bonuses. And we already know Wall Street's getting monster bonuses this year. So
there were also problems this year at the Department of Social Services. Mm-hmm. They have a new leader who's trying to clean things up, but there have been complaints among the rank and file there about her. We had her on the program when Mary Wilson first took the job. But the big story over there is the charity within a charity that they ran, the Giving Tree Christmas Charity. Can somebody explain in a nutshell what that's all about, what the problem is here with that?
Well, I'd like to give it a try because I have kind of a personal interest in this. There's an umbrella group organization called the Giving Tree, and that's a lot of people donated to that, and that was designed to provide money for kids at Christmas. I had started a little thing in partnership with them called Project Joy, which was under that umbrella. And we raised, over a span of 8 or 9 years, some like $400,000 mm-hmm. for kids, for foster kids, is what my part of it was at Christmas. And I think what frustrates me personally, and I think certainly a lot of people who are trying to be watchdogs of all this, is that even though there's been multiple audits, the county has looked at this, I've looked at it, lots of people in our business have looked at it, we don't know what happened there.
Why not? The auditor resigned.
Well, because there are conflicting views of where the money went and how it was spent and the policies involved in that. And I think I suspect it's going to have to end up in court or something before everybody has to sit down, speak under oath, figure out what happened, and to get a better sense of it. Because there are differing interpretations of why certain people were allowed to put money into their personal accounts. Mm-hmm. And
well, why is the Department of Social Services, a government organization, running a charity that gives toys to children at Christmas?
Well, I think that started years and years ago where the county looked at, and they're far from the only government organization that's done this sort of thing. The county looked at needs that aren't being met by the charities that are out there. Mm-hmm. How mine started was, the partnership I did was, foster kids, older foster kids were not getting helped by the Christmas Bureau and the Salvation Army and a lot of the sort of things. It was a gap. And so I think the intention at the beginning was to fill those gaps.
Okay.
And in some ways, it was too successful because all of a sudden there was a lot of money to look at, right, and a lot of money to deal with and people who weren't experienced in handling those amounts.
Rob, you've spoken both to Mecklenburg County Commission Chairman Jennifer Roberts and to Mary Wilson, who took over at DSS long after these problems arose. What are their feelings about all this? Do they feel they've gotten to the bottom of this? Are they hopeful that they will get to the bottom of it?
Well, Jennifer's a bit more removed from it than Mary, and Jennifer is satisfied with the explanations coming from Harry Jones, the county manager, and from Mary Wilson as well so far. The problem that I've had in speaking with Mary, she's been forthright, but we always get to a jam when I ask her, where is the investigation now? And the response is generally, it's in the hands of the police. And I haven't gotten anything further than that. The money has been, except for what, $32,000 mm-hmm. has been recovered?
I don't know.
I think I think they've identified where it is, and all but $32,000 has been recovered.
There's a similar problem with the United Way, because you get to a certain point and they say, well, the past is past and we're moving on. Well, when you're a public organization, the past is not the past.
And I can understand why Mary's point of view in that this all occurred prior to my arrival. I'm trying to clean up the mess and be assured that this does not occur again. But still, I'm sure $32,000, as Tommy rightly knows, is a lot of money for needy children. Mm-hmm. And where is that money? Hopefully not in the hands of somebody who used it for his or her own gain.
Let's move on because we only have an hour. They only give us an hour. I don't understand that. CMS. Simone, you do a lot of work with covering the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system, and there are also budget problems at the schools this year because of the economic downturn and because the state wasn't able to fund them to the level that they had promised, et cetera. And at one point, they announced some fairly big layoffs of personnel, including teachers. Where do we stand with all of that right now?
Well, it turns out the grand total of teachers that were laid off was 665, and they have been able to hire back 160. And according to CMS, this was the biggest reduction in force. That's like an internal term that they use for positions that are removed mm-hmm. permanently. This is the biggest in their recent memory that they've had.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was, an article in the paper this morning about on the CMS website, they show more employees than before these cuts, but that's because they're counting part-timers.
Exactly. Positions, one position could become two or three mm-hmm. in the way they calculate, so the numbers look bigger.
And the school board changed its composition after the fall election this year. There were hopes in some quarters that the new board would be less fractious than the old board. Has that proven to be the case? They only had one or two meetings so far.
They've had one meeting. It was the most controversial thing to walk into because of a couple of lingering votes that were taken by the last board on related to school boundaries and Myers Park High School. And they're looking a little more cohesive than I thought. I thought there was going to be a little more tension there. And it's looking like there are two people who will be willing to stand up against the grain. We're not going to see anything the likes of a Larry Gavreau, you know, who's really vocal, but we are going to see some views that are going to be differing, but it'll be one or two. I think they will always have a hard time trying to get a majority in votes.
The previous board took that very controversial vote about pupil assignment just before they went out of office, which I thought was rather odd, because you would think that for a vote like that, that they would save that for the new board, but the new board came in and did not reverse the previous decision, which rankled a lot of people.
Indeed, it did. It really made people angry. But the reasoning of the old board for doing that was because January is the time when kids need to register for school, when magnet programs are being figured out. So they really wanted to move on this these student assignment plans and get them in place. And I think that was also the reasoning that the new board used, because we want to move along for the next school year.
Any problems or major fights that you see going forward in the new year with the school system?
Oh yeah, there's going to be a huge fight about what is the process we're going to take whenever we redraw a boundary, because what happened this past 8 months, 11 months of just boundary issues, starting with the new Mint Hill High School, have really brought out all of these kinds of, you know, you're putting in for, the public is saying, we're not getting enough clarity on what you're trying to do. The board doesn't seem to have clarity on what they're supposed to be doing, because their policy is very nebulous. It's got this language that is just kind of wishy-washy, and things aren't so clear about how they're going to draw these boundaries.
And evidently, we're going to have new boundary disputes in 2012, because the census figures will be out by then, and we may have to redraw yet again. I have 30 seconds here before we have to go to the break. New mayor in town after 14 years. Pat McCrory hung it up, decided not to run again. Have we been able to see any change in terms of philosophy that we can point to? This is going to be different from here on out?
In 30 seconds?
Yeah. Well, do it. I'll let you come back on the other side if you can't finish.
You know, not just yet. I haven't anyway. Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I just think it's interesting that, you know, Pat McCrory was a moderate. I think Anthony Fox is a moderate. I don't expect huge changes in any direction.
Okay, we have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Blumenthal Performing Arts Center, presenting Defending the Caveman, an hilariously insightful play about the ways men and women relate. December 26th through December 31st in the Booth Playhouse. Tickets at BlumenthalCenter.org. Tis the season for shopping and giving. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, last-minute gift buying, and end-of-the-year donations. What consumer holiday spending and charitable giving trends tell us about the strength of the nation's economy. That's That's coming up at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. Guest host Michelle Martin in there talking about all of this. We're going to continue our conversation about the year's top news stories in the Charlotte area. And if we have time, a top 10 list. David Letterman, you got nothing on us here today. That's coming up. Stay with us.
Keeping up with the news has never been more important or more expensive. That's why WFAE is asking for your tax-deductible contribution as this year comes to a close. All it takes is a gift of a dollar or two a week. The money you give will go directly into paying for the NPR news you'll be using next year. It will also help ensure that WFAE is available for the entire community. Please send your check today or give online at WFAE.org. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in our Spirit Square studio today with four reporters who have covered the big stories of 2009. They would be Rob Bovaire from News 14 Carolina. He's the morning anchor there on Time Warner Cable's All News Channel. Simone Orendine and Julie Rose with WFAE News, and Tommy Tomlinson, a columnist and sometime reporter for the Charlotte Observer. You guys want to go back to the school system for just a second and talk about pay for performance, something that both Pete Gorman, the superintendent, and Eric Davis, the new board chair, are on board with. Rob, you just had a conversation with what, Eric?
With Eric, yeah. And I'm sure that Dr. Gorman is going to be quite pleased by the fact that Eric seems to be on board with this as well. The most sticky issue is going to be how to gauge performance. We've all had those teachers in school who helped us emerge as adults, but didn't necessarily do it in the classroom, didn't cause us to go from a B to an A, mm-hmm. and have something that was clearly quantifiable, but were nonetheless successful as teachers for us. And Dr. Gorman recognizes that there are some nebulous issues that maybe need to be dealt with, or necessarily have to be dealt with first before they can put that policy in place.
Okay. Mecklenburg County voted, was it last week, on domestic partner benefits for employees. Did this come out of thin air, or has this been under consideration for some time? I'm not sure who to ask this question of, Simone.
I think that issue comes and goes from time to time. For as long as I've been here, for these past 5 years, it's on the table, it gets off the table. Bill James will say something, and there's a little bit of, you know, discussion about it, and then it goes away. And this was, I was surprised it suddenly came up, and then they voted on it, yeah. And it, just like that.
And, so. And what do you know? Bill James did say something, and that raised a little ruckus. I just happened to be going through the channels on Sunday, and they were playing back the county commission meeting, and Vilma Leek was talking about the vote that she was about to make and why she was about to make it, and talking about her late son who died of AIDS and who was gay. And at the end of it, Jennifer Roberts, the chairwoman, began to talk. And then you hear Vilma Leek saying, "Don't you talk about my son." And only because I read the news story did I know who and what she was responding to.
Yeah.
Where is this? Has this blown over? Is Bill James going to make an apology? Does he need to make an apology? Does she feel he needs to make an apology? What's the deal here?
Well, I was going to say, I don't think he's going to make an apology. I don't think he feels he needs to. I think he probably, it probably wouldn't hurt to do that. It was sort of a cruel thing to say, even if he didn't have ill intent in saying it. I think looking back, he should probably know that whether he intended for that to hurt her or not, it did. Having said all that, I think we tend to get a little too caught up in who's mad at who and who's saying bad things about who. The fact is, Bill's side lost. You know, the domestic partner benefits passed. And no matter what he says about it, no matter what he says after that, that passed, and that's now county policy. And so, you know, I think sometimes it's better to look at what actually happened than, you know, what people are saying about each other.
Well, let's look at what happens here from going forward, because we're in the middle of a recession, et cetera, and we've just passed a policy that will cost the county some money. Do we know how much money it will cost the county?
I think it's going to be minimal. I remember talking to somebody saying it was like six people would be able to take advantage of something along those lines. It was fairly small, the number of people.
And I mean, we're just finding out today that it looks like the city's going to have this debate now as well. That, you know, Mayor Fox is apparently in support of this and going to ask, you know, the staff to look into offering this to city employees as well. So,
and I think that's, you know, I think one thing that's probably going to happen as a result of this is that people who are in a heterosexual unmarried relationship are also going to say, well, what about us? And I think that's fair and right.
Isn't the answer to that get married?
Well, I think the,
sorry.
I guess it could be. I mean,
that's my opinion.
That's the answer to that.
There are also
that's
instances.
The same thing that gay couples would like to say, if you would let us get married, we would. But I think it becomes more of an issue about sort of how people live now.
Okay. And bear in mind that the policy is in line with most major employers in the U.S. It's not out of bounds necessarily, or at least that far out of bounds.
And the banks led the way on this in this community because of their nationwide spread and the fact that Bank of America was in San Francisco, of all places, and now Wells Fargo as well. There was some question or some talk about challenging this legally in the courts, but hasn't the precedent been set because it's been these kind of benefits are in place in other parts of North Carolina, including Wake County and Chapel Hill and places like that. Do we know about this?
I've heard about it.
I don't know that much. I think it would be hard to challenge in the courts. Okay. I think it would be easier for there to be a majority in a future election that overturned it. That's possible.
Okay. Miracle on the Hudson. Don't want to spend too much time on this, but this was a big story in Charlotte because the plane in New York that landed in the Hudson was on its way here, and a lot of Charlottians were on board.
And Captain Sully is a local hero, and he comes to town, and hundreds of people show up to cheer him on. So, yeah.
Amazing. Former brother-in-law was actually on that flight, and I'm just astounded. I asked him about it, and he said that he thought this is it.
Yeah.
When the plane started to head down, this is a young guy, too.
Well, we had a conversation about this with two of the people who were on that flight a couple of months ago, which we're going to play back in the coming week because we're off. And it's a deeper conversation than I anticipated it being. We get into a lot of things that go well below the surface of all of this and what has happened to these people and their points of view on life as a result of having gone through this experience.
I can't imagine it not changing your point of view on things.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a young father or something like that.
Well, Bill Belk changed his point of view. He wanted to be a judge because of what had happened to him at the hands of a judge, and he became a judge. Now he's not a judge. He resigned in November. He was facing misconduct charges at the time and did not explain his exit when he left. He just left. What were the charges? Do we know today why he did he resign just to get out of having to deal with that, or what was the deal?
Well, I think he could see coming that they were going to be he's going to be put up for, you know, some sort of discipline from the judicial commissions that have to deal with that. And I think he probably, although I don't know this for a fact, I think he probably resigned to basically keep from being fired or punished in some other way. But I think what's interesting about that whole case is that here's somebody who's takes on a job and asks for a job as a judge. Mm-hmm. And a judge's job is basically to make sure that society plays by the rules. And what brought him down to this is that he did not want to play by the rules of being a judge. The rules say if you're going to be a judge, you have to get off these corporate boards and you have to not take money from these folks. And he wanted to do both. And maybe there should be some sort of legal question about whether that's allowed or not. But at the time, that wasn't the rule.
Well, he also is not an attorney, has no real legal background, correct?
Well,
no.
He is an attorney.
Oh, he is? Okay.
Yeah. But he's never practiced.
I see. But doesn't it raise questions about how we choose judges?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I could not understand people saying, how could this possibly happen, when I would look and wonder, well, this is how judges are elected. I mean, this is how judges are selected here. If one does not like the fact that Bill Belk is elected as a judge, then I would hope that people would try to change the way that they are selected.
Yeah. We don't do a good job, and I mean everybody, of sort of covering these races and really talking about what the requirements of the job are and how difficult they are. And so I think a lot of it comes down to stuff like name recognition. Mm-hmm. If Mike Collins was running for judge, Mike Collins would probably win as a judge, no matter how horrible that might be for the legal system.
And it would be.
And it would be. you know, that's that's probably the case because citizens don't do a good enough job, and the people who cover these sorts of races don't do a good enough job of explaining what's required in the job and how difficult it is.
However, when I run for judge, I hope I don't have to run against you because you'll win. For the better part of the year, the Raleigh News and Observer, your sister newspaper, has been running investigative reports on former North Carolina Governor Mike Easley and alleged abuses of his office. It's an ongoing investigation. No charges, I don't think, have been filed as of yet, but we have seen Mary Easley resign from her position at NC State University and some other resignations at that university connected to Mary Easley's getting a job there. What is happening now with that investigation?
Well,
or those investigations?
It's sort of a long unraveling of, you know, what was Governor Easley involved in? You know, what was it legal? Was it maybe illegal but unethical? Was it criminal in any way? And I think those things, you know, you have to be very careful before you charge somebody who's been the governor of your state with something very serious. And so I think it takes a long time for this stuff to sort of unravel and come together. But I think it's clear that, you know, sort of the MO of the governor while he was in office, you know, the sort of shorthand on him was that he wasn't doing a whole lot. Well, it turns out he was doing a whole lot, just maybe not what the state had hoped.
So no legal charges have been filed yet.
I don't think
so. No, the Board of Elections finished its investigation, and it turned over, it recommended that the district attorney investigate.
Okay.
So that's where it's standing right now.
You know, I sat here and had a conversation a couple of years ago with some people fairly high up in state government who made a point of saying to me how proud they were that North Carolina government is clean. The political campaigns that we run can get down and dirty, but that the government is clean. And yet we have the Jim Black situation. We have this investigation into Mike Easley. We have allegations that there's a lot of patronage going on.
Tony Rand.
In Raleigh that affects Mecklenburg County and other areas of the state. Will all of this prick somebody into some sort of push to reformation?
I think if legal action is taken against Easley, that will really kind of, I mean, there's a little bit of ethics reform that's going on. Purdue is looking into the transportation board and that sort of thing. So there's a little bit of movement, but I think once someone higher up, like in Easley, you know, if they pursue him further, then there will be the prick, is my opinion.
Mark Sanford in South Carolina has his own problems. Julie, he made headlines because of his dalliance with a woman in Argentina, but more importantly, he left the state and didn't tell anybody where he was. And in South Carolina, you can't even call out the National Guard without the governor being able to do. The governor is the only person that can do it. So, how has he avoided impeachment, Julie?
Well, because in order to be impeached, lawmakers have to find either serious crimes or serious misconduct, and, you know, after 6 months of threats to impeach and calls for resignation, and everybody at the State House is angry at Sanford, the House representatives in the House haven't been able to come up with anything that's anything more than hypocrisy and what they call, you know, dumb stuff that the governor did, but not enough, they feel like, to really go forward with impeachment. So he's going to, you know, it looks like he's going to serve out the last year of his term.
And Jenny Sanford has impeached him. She's getting a divorce, and evidently, is that the last we'll hear of this, do you think, until her book comes out?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that people are camped out down there in Argentina trying to find out if he's still in touch with his former girlfriend and, you know, where that's going to go. So I'm sure this won't be the end of it, although Sanford would really like it to be.
I'm going to leave minutes for the end of the show here. I want to take 1 minute and talk about the state of newspapers, because it's no joke that the state of the newspaper business is in real trouble here, as is the television business, by the way. It's not just newspapers. It's the whole media infrastructure is collapsing in zeros and ones, meaning digital. What is the state of the Charlotte Observer right now today?
I'll have to go back and check after the office to make sure we're still there and I've got a desk and everything. No, it's a glass half empty or half full situation. We still have the biggest news operation in Charlotte, certainly, probably in the Carolinas. We still probably put out more news every day than anybody else. And a lot of it we do is really good stuff. However, there's no question that we have lost a lot of our staff, not just in the newsroom, but in advertising and circulation in all those places. And we're trying to figure out, as everybody else is trying to figure out, how to make money on the internet. Mm-hmm. We make our print circulation is dwindling, but that's where we make the vast amount of our money. And so if we can figure out, and anybody else can figure out, how journalism can thrive and make money on the internet, then we'll be okay. But that's a big if.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where we're at right now.
Stop giving it away. There's a first clue to that. All right. Before we leave the air today, the news department, WFAE, has put together a little top 10 list of the top news stories that made headlines in Charlotte in 2009. And we have Simone Orendine and Julie Rose on behalf of the entire news department to give us the top 10 list. Number 10.
Throw nothing but interceptions.
Number 9.
Yell, "You lie," in a formal meeting.
Number 8.
Draw a school boundary and call a school a hoe.
Number 7.
Build a coal-fired power plant.
Okay. Number 6.
Let questions linger about the validity of your college degree.
Ooh, number 5.
Lay off workers and then take a big bonus for yourself.
Number 4.
Make promises about I-485.
We didn't talk about that, did we? Number 3.
Take lots of perks from campaign donors and forget to report them.
Number 2.
Take federal bailout money.
And the number one way to make Charlotte headlines in 2009...
Go hiking on the Appalachian Trail.
Weak. Weak, not you guys, the rim shot. Weak rim shot. You can look for an end-of-the-decade summary in the Charlotte Observer, thanks to Tommy Tomlinson. Although, Tommy, if I recall correctly from our 2000-2001 conversations, the decade didn't begin until 2001 because the new century didn't begin until 2000. We don't want to get into that argument.
Well, what I've chosen to believe is that we started with year zero, and that clears everything
that's
up.
What you've chosen to believe. Tommy Tomlinson with the Charlotte Observer, columnist there, and an award-winning one at that. Rob Bovaire, who can be seen every day on News 14 Carolina on Time Warner Cable. You guys are healthy, aren't you?
I have a job.
Okay. And Simone Orendine and Julie Rose, reporters from WFAE News. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. Have a great Christmas. Have a great New Year.
Charlotte Talks is a